come with me to Indiana, back to 1855, to the little town of Terre Haute, where railroading once thrived. There Eugene Victor Debs was born, and before that boy could stand, he told the world and his mom gonna be railroad man.
Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today.
He was the most loved and the most hated man. And I might add that he was the least understood man.
Schubert Sebree, remembering Eugene Debs, the American socialist, political activist, and trade unionist, who was one of the founding members of the Industrial Workers of the World, and five times the candidate of the Socialist Party of America for President of the United States. Sebree was just 10 years old when he met Debs, and went on to be active in the Debs for Congress Committee.
Any semblance of public interaction, use of the streets, public gatherings, this is what public health workers are trying to help us recapture. And if, in fact, they are risking their own lives to create a public life for the rest of us, then I think we need to ask, what are some historical precedents?
This week marks the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II and the closure of the conflict in the Pacific Theater. While we're closely familiar with the contribution of American industrial workers to the war effort, the end of the war opened up a new significant chapter for labor, in which many of the gains of the previous decades were thrown into jeopardy. Producer Patrick Dixon spoke with Laura McEnany, professor of history at Whittier College and the author of Post-War: Waging Peace in Chicago, to discuss the fate of labor's complex New Deal coalition and connect the essential workers of the 1940s with those fighting today's war against the pandemic. On this week's Labor History in 2, Rick Smith tells us about the day that young women workers at the YH Trading Company in Seoul, South Korea, staged a sit-in.
Then 1,000 police stormed the building. They overturned furniture and broke windows. They dragged the women out of the building violently.
That's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. Here's the show.
What's your philosophy? I'll tell you my philosophy, it's simple as can be. Wherever there's a cry for justice, that's where I will be. As long as there's a soul in prison, I cannot be free.
American socialist, political activist, and trade unionist Eugene Victor Debs was one of the founding members of the Industrial Workers of the World and five times the candidate of the Socialist Party of America for President of the United States. Schubert Sebree's father was a railroad worker and a member of the American Railway Union, which was organized by Debs in 1893. Sebree was just 10 years old when he met Debs, and as a young boy, he led a strike in a Terre Haute glassworks, remaining active in his union, the Glass Bottle Blowers Association. A member of the local Socialist Party, Sebree assisted in Debs' campaigns for president, including driving the Model T used by Debs to campaign throughout the district when he ran for Congress in 1916. During the Depression, Schubert Sebree organized the Debs Society to memorialize Eugene Debs and to educate people about socialism. In 1962, when the Debs Foundation was formed, Sebree became an active member and led the yearly pilgrimage to Debs' grave. He died in 1980 in Terre Haute. In 1985, Steve Hansis sent Saul Schnardeman a cassette tape of an interview with Schubert Sebree. Saul, director of the Inventory of American Labor Landmarks and former editor of Talking Union, is one of the founders of the Labor Heritage Foundation. He worked with the Meany Labor Archives at the University of Maryland to preserve this interview and make it widely available.
But I remember listening to one of the speeches Debs made, in which he was talking about the condition of the miners in Colorado working for the Rockefeller mining interests. And it was a scathing denunciation of Rockefeller as an individual, because Rockefeller knew all of the things that were going on, had a very keen mind, and he had people that told him all the things that were connected with these businesses. So he had no excuse for not knowing the brutality that was taking place in the mines, the bribery and corruption of local officials, even up to the governor of the state of Colorado. Rockefeller knew all these things. And then Debs attacked it, his piety, his hypocrisy. The man who attended church regularly and yet had so little consideration for his employees that he was permitted these guns and gunmen and thugs to terrorize the communities of miners. And yet at the conclusion of his denunciation of Rockefeller as an example of the capitalists, he walked to the center of the stage and he said, "What I've said about Rockefeller doesn't mean that I hate Rockefeller, or that I wouldn't help him if he was in distress. I would help him as willingly as I would help anyone." Now that seems like a contradiction, but Debs had the philosophy that people were the product of two factors over which they had no control. One factor was what they inherited from their ancestors. And the other factor was the way those inherited traits were acted upon by environment. And that the so-called freedom of the will was, it had so influence, so small influence in shaping human conduct, that it shouldn't be counted against any individual. That Rockefeller was Rockefeller because of circumstances and because of inherited traits. He was Eugene Debs because he'd been brought forth in a different environment, grown up in a different environment, had different traits that he'd inherited from ancestors. The criminal that went to prison. Eugene didn't condemn the criminal because he knew that if he'd been inherited the same traits, been subjected to the same environment, he would have been in prison. As he said, if the other man had inherited my traits and been subjected to my environment, he would be in my place. So, as I say, he was the most loved and the most hated man. And I might add that he was the least understood man when it came to these personal qualities. Only a very few of his intimates understood Debs' philosophy that influenced his thinking. However, in one of these writings, and I think it was published in the International Socialist Review, if I remember, he was going through Colorado, and I guess they went up on the mountainside, and here in the ideal location were giant trees 80 feet in height. But when you got up to the limits of vegetation in the high altitude, well, these same trees were just bushes. They were dwarfed by their environment, stunted and dwarfed. And he had talked with someone who said, "Will you bring a seed from the dwarfed trees, planted down this ideal environment, and they'll become giants 80 feet tall. You you take these seats and these trees in the 80-foot environment, put them there where they limit the vegetation, stunts their growth, and they'll develop into shrubs. And so it was Deb's idea that if you change the environment, the social environment in which people live, and you created an ideal environment, that then we'd all grow to be giants 80 feet tall.
Schubert Sabri, remembering American socialist, political activist, and trade unionist Jean Debs. This week marks the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II and the closure of the conflict in the Pacific Theater. It's been a muted celebration. What might have represented a final reconvening for some of the war's remaining veterans has been postponed by the pandemic. And while we're closely familiar with the contribution of American industrial workers to the war effort, the end of the war opened up a significant new chapter for labor in which many of the gains of previous decades were thrown into jeopardy. Labor History Today producer Patrick Dixon spoke about this with Laura McEnany, professor of history at Whittier College and the author of Post-War Waging Peace in Chicago. McEnany not only discusses the fate of labor's complex New Deal coalition, but connects the essential workers of the 1940s to those fighting today's war against the pandemic.
Okay, so thank you so much for joining me today. August 14th marks the 75th anniversary of VJ Day and the formal end of World War II. It seemed a good opportunity to talk to you. Well, many, perhaps mistakenly, tend to think of the early 1940s as, I think, a period of great collective action and unified purpose. Did this time also represent a contest to determine the shape of the post-war nation?
Part of me thinks it can be both. I mean, of course, the end of the war was greeted with a great collective sigh of relief. You know, the violence, the destruction, the ongoing struggle of it was certainly greeted with collective happiness. But what happened after that is really the focus of my book. What did it mean to make peace? And what emerges even before the war ends is a debate about the size and the scope of the post-war state. And there are a lot of ways in which we can see this as a conservative resurgence. Conservatives had to tolerate a bigger state during World War II. And what they saw in the peace was this opportunity to use a big war to make a small state. That is, to not only roll back the increase in the size of the state, the role of the state in the 40s to support the war, but to roll back the New Deal state, the state that was built in the 1930s. Now, in opposition to that, when we look at working class voices from American cities, we see that American citizens had shared some of the discomforts about the highly regulatory state of wartime, but they did not want to roll back the state. And if we look at working class voices, we start to see in this period a kind of growing war liberalism. That is, a language of worthiness and entitlement to some of the state's benefits based on war sacrifice. And what's interesting about this war liberalism is it was portable, it was flexible, it was capacious. A lot of Americans saw themselves as part of the sacrifice, and so they thought that there should be some reward or recompense in return. So at the end of World War II, we see lots of ideas being floated about what should happen to the state. And conservative voices were certainly ascendant, but we can't forget if we reach into working class urban neighborhoods, we also see a very robust war liberalism that emerged as well.
So it's easy for us to locate the opinions from that time of prominent national figures, I mean, even some who are probably quite insightful, Walter Ruth or Eleanor Roosevelt and so on. But when you look at community level discussions, were these at odds from those that you'd find in the pages of the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the ways we can think again about what this post-war moment meant in the United States is, as you say, look beyond the highly publicized opinions of the national figures and go into the neighborhoods of American cities where we see early dialogues of war liberalism, and we see them from different parts of the American working class. And one of the ways we can do this is by looking at the state, I think, in broader ways. There's a scholar of the welfare state, Linda Gordon, who has always said that the state is more than the government. And if we look in the opinion pages and we look at the writing of national figures in the New York Times, of course, they're talking about the levers of the American state at higher levels. But one of the things I talk about is the state in the neighborhood. That is, the many small states in the post-war city. Those included the Travelers Aid Society, the YMCA, the local offices of the Veterans Administration, the Office of Price Administration. And if we look into the states in the neighborhood, we start to see different kinds of dialogues about post-war liberalism. But the historian has to look harder for those. And we have to look into the records of nonprofits, neighborhood organizations, and we have to try to find those working class voices. And because of the way we assign value to different voices in history and the way we organize our records, those voices are a little harder to find.
And you chose Chicago as a lens through which to consider this important period. Now, we weren't necessarily discussing the literature. Other historians have held up Chicago as a real model of New Deal coalition politics. Mm-hmm. Can you share with us what made this such a complex and revealing city to study?
Yeah, I think Chicago is interesting. I certainly, you know, stand on the shoulders of other historians who have done great work on Chicago. I think Chicago in the post-war is a particularly interesting place. I mean, first of all, if we look at the city, it is a place where the two punctuation marks of the war emerged. Roosevelt made his famous 1937 quarantine speech in Chicago, and of course, Chicago is the birthplace of the atomic bomb. So it has these two punctuation marks. But more than that, it is a place where we see the interactions among diverse groups of working class Americans. We see the white working class with European origins, and we see two generations of that white working class. We see immigrants themselves and the daughters and sons of those immigrant groups. We see the continuing history of the Great Migration, that is the migration from the South of African Americans to the North, Chicago being a hub of that for decades. And then we see a new migration created by the war itself of Japanese Americans who are leaving their concentration camps and moving to Chicago because the federal government thinks that it is an acceptable place west of the Mississippi to have Japanese war refugees resettle. So it is this place where we get to see this interaction, a sort of laboratory of working class, multiracial populations working out their own versions of what post-war should mean.
And in some of those earlier histories on the 1930s, these diverse populations are able to, at least to some degree, congeal around certain ideas and certain principles. Does that happen in the post-war period too?
Well, I think we need to maybe revisit that when we think about the post-war. I would say that when we're talking about working class Japanese Americans, African Americans, and the white working class, each group had a distinctive war liberalism, as I said, a kind of language of entitlement and worthiness that was based on their service either a civilian or soldier in the war. So each group had a version of war liberalism. But I would not say what came out of the post-war was a multiracial political coalition. Sometimes those their war liberalisms spoke to one another and with one another. We certainly see multiracial alliances as post-war Americans try to get their peace dividend. But we also see in the post-war cities a kind of racial jockeying, that is, that Japanese Americans are calculating what is going to be their racial language of war liberalism. Are they going to speak in unison with African American organizations? In some places they do, in some places they don't. There is a kind of discomfort with linking up with the African-American movements in the post-war period. White working classes in Chicago are only somewhat comfortable with Japanese-Americans. There is wariness, certainly, of making common cause with Japanese-Americans and absolute hostility in some places to making common cause with either Japanese-Americans or African-Americans. So what I would say is that we see a post-war liberalism, a war liberalism, in each of these groups, but I would not say what comes out of the post-war period is a coalition, a multiracial coalition. They're all using the language of war liberalism, but white supremacy in the white working class means that this doesn't coalesce into a multiracial vision.
Does this dissonance ultimately undermine their ability then to preserve any sort of vision of a war liberalism beyond the 1940s?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, again, there are other historians have written about the possibility and the tragedy of this moment. As African Americans are contemplating what they need in the peace, and they talk about it as a real peace, quote unquote, they're trying to find jobs and housing and health care, and African American GIs are trying to find the same entitlements as white GIs. But white working class Americans are not willing to make common cause with them. African Americans are renters, they're consumers, they're workers, and they have a very robust black war liberalism. But there is clearly a white supremacy operative which prevents common cause even between Japanese Americans and African Americans, and certainly between white working class Americans and Japanese Americans and black Americans. We see alliances, but they are not strong enough to create a multiracial coalition in the post-war period.
When we consider the present crisis, the crisis of the COVID-19 pandemic, many have declared the national effort to overcome it as a war on disease, including but not exclusively President Trump. I know you've recently been thinking about how post-war efforts and the 1944 GI Bill have some parallels between state planning in the wake of previous wars and how we might meet the challenges of today.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Whenever I hear a president using a war metaphor, and other presidents have talked about the war on drugs, the war on poverty, I think we have to pause and think about what that means. So I want to say that I'm wary of the war metaphor, because I don't know that the language of militarism is a pathway to creating more democracy in the wake of a war. But if we're going to call it a war, we can look back to a historical precedent in which an audacious and generous welfare state was built in the wake of World War II. And one of the things we know from the work of Suzanne Mettler and other scholars who have studied the GI Bill is that when big government worked well, it created a positive attitude among its users. American citizens could see governance not just government, but governance, the administrative functions of a high-functioning government that could help them, that could arbitrate disputes, that could regulate where regulation needed to happen, that could support them with a safety net. When Americans after World War II saw that and used that GI Bill, or when they used things like rent control to protect their hard-earned wages, they supported government and they supported governance. They saw a role for it. And if the struggle in the pandemic, if we're going to accept that we call it a war and that we're going to stand in a kind of war footing, then I think we have to think about the essential workers in this war and what do they need and what do they deserve as they are trying to preserve life for all of us, and not just our own lives, but a kind of public life, any semblance of public interaction, use of the streets, public gatherings. This is what public health workers are trying to help us recapture. And if, in fact, they are risking their own lives to create a public life for the rest of us, then I think we need to ask, what are some historical precedents that can help us reward them and not just say thank you for your service, but give them the kind of state supports that they deserve.
And many have pointed out some of the limitations of the GI Bill in not necessarily being the most inclusive piece of legislation. Presumably we need to learn some lessons there too.
Absolutely. There's some wonderful histories that look at race and the GI Bill. And one of the things about the GI Bill is that it was federally created but locally controlled. And when you put federal programs, but this was true, of course, of the New Deal, and this is true, this is a characteristic of much of the American welfare state, a kind of local implementation of federal mandates. But when you empower local communities in ways that give them opportunities to deliver that welfare in anti-democratic ways based on race, you create local programs that do not really deliver local care. The GI Bill, for example, was implemented by banks in the South, real estate agents in the South, loan officers in the South, school administrators in the South, and even in the North. We should not only isolate the South here. That meant that when African-American GIs were trying to get their piece of the GI Bill, they had to fight the kind of white supremacy embedded in local control, in the local offices that were supposed to deliver their federal entitlements. So when we think about local control of federal programs, we have to be very careful about setting really clear guidelines about the way it's implemented and making sure that there is regulation when the local delivery of that federal welfare is not done with any kind of democracy.
This has been really insightful. I do appreciate you sharing your time with us today. Thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Laura McEnany, professor of history at Whittier College and the author of Post-War, Waging Peace in Chicago. She spoke with Labor History Today producer Patrick Dixon.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day that young women workers at the YH Trading Company in Seoul, South Korea, staged a sit-in strike. The women made wigs for export. The company had been one of the leading exporters in the nation. But then the managers began to move the profits from the wig company to a shipping company under the same ownership, as well as to a film production company. This drained the profits from the wig factory and left it in massive debt. The owners shut down the company without warning, firing all of the employees. These women did not only lose their jobs. Water and electricity were turned off at the factory dormitories where the workers lived. A union represented the young women. The union planned a strike at the building, but the police were called in to break it up. The workers decided to move their protest to the local headquarters of the New Democratic Party. The party was in opposition to the leader of Seoul, President Park Chung-hee. the fired women were welcomed at the new Democratic Party headquarters. There, they decided to stage a sit-in to bring attention to their situation. The workers' sit-in only lasted 3 days. Then, 1,000 police stormed the building. They overturned furniture and broke windows. They dragged the women out of the building violently. One woman, 21-year-old Kim Young-suk, died in the raid. She fell from the roof of the building in a clash with the police. 4 of the union leaders were sent to prison. More than 200 of the workers were expelled out of the city of Seoul and sent back home to rural areas. Today's Labor History in 2 brought to you in memory of Carol Hillman, a passionate friend of workers and volunteer of the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. Even better, if you like what you hear, please like it on your podcast app and pass it along. You can be part of Labor History Today by reading a labor history item. Just shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Our music today was The Ballad of Eugene Victor Debb, sung by Joe Glazer. Thanks to Saul Schneiderman for sharing the Schubert Sabri interview. Saul has a great newsletter called Friday's Labor Folklore. You can subscribe by emailing him at fridaysfolklore@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to Labor History in 2 wherever you listen to podcasts. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. Editing today by Patrick Dixon. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe Daniel, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.
What's your philosophy? I'll tell you my philosophy. It's simple as can be. Wherever there's a cry for justice, that's where I will be. As long as there's a soul in prison, I cannot